One of the biggest theater events of the year has landed at the Detroit Opera House. Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations, tells the story of one of the most successful groups to ever come from the Motown label. It's told through the eyes of Otis Williams, the last surviving original member of the group, which he helped found back in 1960. Otis shared his story with the acclaimed playwright Dominique Mariso, who is originally from Detroit too. Dominique was back home for the opening night of Ain't Too Proud, which is being staged at the Opera House now through August 28th. She sat down with me to share what it was like working with Otis, getting that story of the Temptations right, and how a call for social justice today helped inform how she went about writing this musical.
Trayvon Martin had been murdered by George Zimmerman. Michael Brown had been murdered, and Ferguson had, you know, undergone. We had our first sort of like national protest against police violence and the sanctioned killings of, you know, Black men during 2014, during that, like during the summer before this project approached.
The Justice Department will not press federal charges against George Zimmerman, the man who was acquitted of murder for killing unarmed Black teen Trayvon Martin in 2012. The case set off a national...
People moving out, people moving in, why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
While I was considering to whether or not to that I would be the right person to take it on, they gave me Otis Williams' biography. And at that time, I was already a part of a lot of different groups and activist groups, artists, activist groups who were trying to figure out what we should do as artists to respond to the times as artists. And how do we use our art to... make change happen in the world, and are we being effective? And so when I read Otis's biography, for the very first time, I started to see how the Temptations were caught in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement and the Black Liberation Movements after that, you know? And I thought, whoa, that must have been a heavy time to be making some Motown music, you know? And I never, because I didn't live through it the first time, you know, I've only heard stories. I lived through Temptations in the 80s, you know? My Temptations were not the originals. I did not ever consider how much what they were doing at the time that they were doing it and how significant that was. Like, when the world was in such a tough place in the 60s, what their music meant to the world. It just changed my whole point of view.
There's a story in Otis's biography about being away from Detroit when the riots were happening here in the city. And I'm curious, you know, from your research and writing this musical, how did the Temptations music start to evolve as these civil rights issues were really taking over the country and taking over their hometown?
Well, my experience of it is, and it's also kind of stated in the musical a little bit, where other groups were becoming more political. You know, you had Edwin Starr, who got War, and the Temptations reported it first. You know, they were sort of known for their ballads. So when the world was starting to become more political, it was sort of hitting the Temptations in a place of like, well, where should they be living? You know, Funkadelic sound was coming in the 70s, you know, and I just think about all of the changing of times, you know, and how much Motown had other kinds of labels that were putting out like political poets and, you know, but that wasn't supposed to be the Temptations gig. And I just thought about what that must have felt like to be from Detroit during the Great Rebellion, as it is called, in 1967. I know there's a gun shyness about calling it riot, the 67 riots, and most historians and people that I talk to who lived through it call it something else, you know, so I always honor that. But I thought it must have been crazy to be making art in 1967 and being away from your hometown when your hometown is up in flames. And what must that have been like to either be of it or to not be of it and be distant from it and feel disconnected from whatever people are feeling on the ground. I can't imagine in 2014 being an artist from Ferguson and being on the road and not having anything to do or say about what was going on. That'd be crazy, you know?
One of the main things that you really put into this musical, Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations, is the push and pull that the band was feeling from Berry Gordy and the label, Motown Records, and what they wanted to do creatively, because Berry Gordy famously gun-shy about letting his artists get political.
And with very valid concerns, you know, that for what it would do to their careers. I think Berry Gordy was very conscious about how to make people last in this industry and become iconic and being a Black label owner and having to figure out how to keep his artists having wide appeal. I mean, that was nobody had done that before. And so for him to have to figure that out, you know, and be the sort of vanguard of it in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily think it was invalid, but I definitely in this story wrestle with what that meant for both Barry's side of things and for, you know, and for the Temptation side of things and for regular artists, you know, and that when the times when that was in alignment, when they were in alignment with that thinking, and sometimes they weren't, and I had to ask him, what the heck is up with that, you know?
That was in the 1960s. You were talking about earlier, you know, back in 2015, 2016, 2017, as an artist trying to figure out ways to cultivate change through your artwork. Have you felt that push and pull of creating something for yourself, for something that could create some altruistic change versus something that is commercially compatible?
Oh, all the time. I mean, it's still going. I think we are still, I mean, I speak for myself, but I also am in conversation with so many artists who are theater artists, also working in television and film. And we all feel like, you know, that there's always seems to be a navigation that we have to do to be our truest, authentic selves as artists and somehow convince people who produce art that we will be enough to have other people want to engage with our art and consume it. You know, we have to do a lot of convincing, a lot of negotiating, and a lot of navigating in order to get our art seen by the masses. And that's been a lifelong navigation for me, but it's also been generations of Black artists in particular, and just artists in general. Generations of artists have had to try to figure out how to stay true to their voice and be a part of a system that consumes art. And I struggle with it to this very day.
Has it gotten easier as you have gotten more notoriety?
In some capacities, and in others, no. Which is disappointing. You know, I can have I talk to other very famous writers, very famous theater artists out here who are still, they're Black women, and they still feel like they're being undermined, still feel like there are people who just will not. Somehow when I have an award behind me or a genius grant behind me is not enough. It's still not enough sometimes. And I still find myself being questioned, doubted by people who have some access to, you know, power or some access to a wider market who still won't trust that what we do, we know what we're doing and that what we do is enough.
It blows my mind sometimes because if money rules everything around me and the world, there is so much money in this audience, minority audiences that are continually ignored. And even when they do show up at the box office or the theater or wherever, they're skeptical.
Well, they're not believing it. Or they go, oh, that must have been a fluke. How many flukes can you have before it's not a fluke, you know? But I think that's just also... It's also an acknowledgement of something that I don't think everybody is ready to do, which is to say that maybe the things you thought you had to depend, that the audience, the one very singularly focused audience that you had in your mind, whatever that is and looks like to you, that that's not all there is, and that you're going to actually have to do some work because you convince yourself that other people aren't going to consume art. So you don't go, you don't try, you don't even try to engage them. But if you have to acknowledge that they are there and they do consume, and that if you want to expand, you're going to have to engage them. And that's going to take some work. I think people are averse to the work that's needed to be done.
Considering all of this, what was part of your decision making in saying, I'm going to take on this story of the Temptations?
Well, I had to think about what could I do to make it theatrical and make it tell a story that could only be told on stage. That's the only reason you tell stories for theater. Like this story, the way that I'm going to tell this for the stage could only be done this way. And that's not the same as what I would do for a movie or what has already been done for the television miniseries that they had, which was amazing. You know, I love it. We all grew up on it. I know everybody that I know can quote every part of that movie.
They come in to see me. They come in to see the Temptations. Ain't nobody coming to see you, Otis.
So I have to be conscious and go, how do I not do what the movie did, but still speak to the same truth that the movie spoke to that made everybody respond to the movie so well. And that's a tricky, tricky navigation. But for me, what I always came back to for me is, how can I make this an experience for the theater, exclusively for the theater? And how do I do that is I have to try to reimagine storytelling. I have to reimagine their story in a most theatrical way possible. You know, people can slide in and out of life and in and out of worlds. Music can mean 10 different things than it normally is supposed to. You can stop this whole moment right here with a song and the song will feel like you're ready to hear it. You know, those are things that I could change the whole construction of this song to not just be, I don't know, the very one linear binary way of looking at love, man and woman, love. Like this could be about love of your brothers. This could be about love of your, you know, your city or your country or your, you know, or anger towards your city or your country, or, you know, like this could just be about a whole bunch of other stuff. It doesn't have to just be about this one binary type of way that we were hearing music in the past. And so those are the things that I decided I would do. I would play with this story in order to make it unique for the stage. But also the other thing I thought would make it just unique in the storytelling that was exciting for me was, hey, nobody really deals when they're dealing with Motown. They never really get into the like the nitty gritty of like, hey, they were going to strike against Motown. like no one ever talks about like, hey, this political conversation. How was that? Like, what were their challenges as artists besides the typical drugs? You know, people focus on musicians. They always focus on drugs. And that's it. That's like their downfall was drugs. And I'm like, no, it was so much more complicated than that. You know, let's deal with the racism that they experienced on the road. And let's deal with the tug and pull of a Black label trying to make these Black artists iconic for everyone, not just for Black audiences. I'm like, what does that look like? And let's deal with some of the political stuff. Let's deal with some of the Otis's personal stuff and the controversial personal stuff that I don't think other people will really dealing with when they deal with their stories. They can kind of make everybody look happy and, you know, a little disgruntled, but not, they don't get as political in TV. So I thought we can get a little more political in theater.
And I think you accomplished that. There's so many fascinating elements of this narrative that you weave into there, but let's be real. You also have to make your words, your writing, your narrative compete with one of the greatest song catalogs of all time. And you have to work that into the story, which, you know, if people haven't seen Dominique, your work in the past, this is a massive departure from work that you've done.
Well, so, yeah, this is my first musical.
Completely. But it's also, you know, beyond that, it was just, you know, this is Broadway mainstream musical stuff. You know, and the plays that you do are so personal, so specific, so intense. I've seen performances of Detroit 67, which you wrote, where the actors themselves are crying and they've already been performing it for 2 weeks. So talk to me about this balancing act that you had of being this acclaimed playwright known for the written word, having to work in this song catalog, too.
Well, you know, it's a great humbling act, to say the least, about your language is not the most important part of the show. In fact, you know, most would tell me when I was first writing a book to a musical, if you do your job, nobody's even going to notice the book. You know, I'm like, really? You know, but like, my job for me was then to not be the feature, really, to be the glue. And to help move the story forward and help arrange the songs, help use the songs effectively enough to where we're not exhausted every time we hear a new song, even if it's our favorite Temptations song. But my other job is that I never looked at myself as in competition with the music. I looked at it as a collaborator with the music. And so that for me, man, like, I don't have to write this big monologue. The song's gonna do that for me. Great. You know, like I can release some of my, because I can be a pretty dense writer, you know, and really the language is my friend. I love dealing with language, but in this, I could be scarce, or at least slightly more scarce than I am as a playwright for my regular plays, you know. So I was like, hey, these songwriters, Smokey Robinson, Norma Whitfield, they're poets all unto themselves. They don't need me, you know, like I can leave this to some of the best songwriters in our history of music, really, to say I can share with them and make space for what they do to be significant and to take over, you know. So that's what you do. I think the best musical, especially when you're doing bio musicals or catalog musicals, I think you have to listen to the music and let the music lead the way. And because I love music, it wasn't that much of it wasn't that heartbreaking for me. It was like, right on, good. Now the music can do it for me, you know, because my language is very musical anyway. I think that inside of me, there wants to hear music for everything that I write. You know, I write to music when I'm even writing straight plays. So yeah, it was just sort of like a happy, it felt right to me. It felt like be a collaborator with the music, and then you don't have to fight it and be in competition with it.
Letting control go as a creative, not the easiest thing to do. I think a lot of people will hear you say, you know, you have to let go of these things. And I'm sure a lot of creatives out there really cringed at that. It's a terrifying idea.
Yeah, sure. But if you want to, it depends on what you're telling stories for. If you're being a storyteller, to me, storytellers are always servants to stories. You know, you do what is best for the story to live. And the best storytellers for me are servants to stories, to good stories, and to the people that they're writing about.
Sunshine, blue skies, please go away. A girl has found another and gone away. With her went my future. My life is filled with gloom. So day after day, I stay locked up in my room. I know to you, it might sound strange, but I wish it would rain. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Cause so badly, I wanna go outside.
You worked very closely with Otis Williams, who's the last surviving original Temptation. You mentioned in the musical, there's been about 25 Temptations throughout the years, and you have to do a service to telling his story. What was that relationship like of working with him and making sure that it's accurate? Because he's the last one around. He gets to really control the narrative in a lot of ways.
He does, for whatever that means to people, better or for better or for worse. But yeah, he's the last one. I found him to be, and as that, I did not find him to be contentious, or I've worked with a lot of people with their real stories. It's really, you know, it's an exhausting task to tell people stories that were real life people, you know. It's hard enough telling stories about fictional people. People try to tell me how to write fictional people. You know what I mean? People that were made up in my imagination. People try to tell me whether I got that right, you know? but don't let it be real life people. That's even harder and more challenging. And so Otis was very generous. He was very, from the very beginning told me he knew that I would have to take liberty with this story. And I was like, I've never met a real life person. Okay, creative license like that. He said that from the get-go. And I was like, really? And what that means for me, that didn't mean anything. It gave me a lot of rope as a writer to really do what I do best. And I always say, if you let a writer do what we do, you know, if you trust your writer, if you don't handcuff us, we can deliver back to you your truth, even if it's not fact for fact. I always say I am more concerned and I am more obedient to the truth than I am to facts. And the difference is facts are, well, it actually happened on Friday, not on Tuesday, right? But the truth is the meaning underneath it happened, that you captured the meaning of it, right? You can get all the facts right and the truth wrong. And I'd rather do it the other way around, you know? Because if you get the truth, facts fall apart, facts fall away, you know? And so that means that you can let something happen a little more creatively and have a little bit more flexibility in how you tell the story. So for instance, Otis's journey with his son, I was able to write a conversation with his son that he never told me happened, but he told me how he felt. And so I could fill in the gaps. My job with Otis was to listen to him talk and then hear what he was saying and then hear what he was saying, what he wasn't saying, hear what he wasn't saying and fill in the gaps. And when I did that for him, when he saw his own story, he saw the truth for himself.
That's one of the most emotional, gut-punching parts of the play where, you know, Otis and the Temptations are on the road all the time, away from their family because they are trying to support their family and maybe getting a little caught up in the lifestyle and the fame. And his son kind of moves on without him because he's become self-sufficient. He, you know, didn't have his dad around. And that comes back around in the musical as well. But it really roots it because you do have this glitz and this glamour and this songbook and all these things going on. But that was a really quiet, powerful moment that gave it so much heart. How did Otis feel, I mean, seeing that for the first time?
You know, I mean, he's the better one to ask. But what I will say is how I felt with him seeing it the first time was terrified because he only watched the first half of the play when he was seeing in workshop form. So he didn't see the second half of the play, which is where all the father and son stuff really comes up. He didn't see that until the first performance that we ever did the show in front of an audience in Berkeley. So I was on pins and needles, like, oh my God, how did he feel about like what he saw? So I went up to him after the whole show. And I never really asked people what they thought about what I've written because I care not to know. Like, I feel like ignorance is bliss. I you know, what other people think of you is none of your business. that's usually the model that I go by. But for him, I had to know. So I went over to him and I just said, hey, so how do you feel? How do you feel about what you saw, you know? And during intermission, he just leaned forward and said to me, you wrote the shit out of this. And that was it for me. So then I took it that he was moved, as he had said before, but that he also felt somehow heard and seen. And that was most important for me.
Yeah, that's a really powerful moment to share. I mean, you were talking about that idea of telling a real life person who lived it, you know, telling their story on the stage. It's like a painter trying to get a likeness right. It can be frightening, but that had to feel good. And at opening night, at Detroit Opera House, Otis admitted on stage that he was bawling like a baby the first time he saw it back in Berkeley.
Yeah. You know, and I just, you know, I always felt very careful, protective for him in telling his story, that I wanted to, for him to be moved, but I never wanted to re-hurt him or re-traumatize him with all the losses that are also in the story. But I think if you do it right, and all I can hope is that I do it right, at least for him, and right for whoever I can do it right for, you will know the journey and the sacrifice, and you'll be able to hear their music and hear about him, but also hear his music differently and with a greater appreciation for all that he went through in order to give the world the gift of the Temptations.
Dominique, you brought it back home after a long road with Ain't Too Proud, Life and Times of the Temptations. It's on a big national tour, but like I said, it's home right now, and you got to come out to that hometown audience with Otis Williams. Take people into that feeling, because I'd have to imagine for you that felt pretty good.
Yeah, it felt great. I mean, being able to have the show be home with in the place where this group was born and the place where just where my love for the Temptations was born, the place where I was born and raised. You know, it felt like a high calling. It felt like long overdue. I mean, we would try to get this show here right before the pandemic. So, you know, having to wait all this time, but it just makes it that much more sweet once it finally happens. We just feel so blessed to be able to have had that special opening night here in Detroit and to have the show here. All of the people who couldn't get to New York can now see the show. And people who did go to New York get to see it again, you know, because I find that it's a show that I miss. I personally missed it. I've been needing parts of it to see again. And just they heal me. They make me feel celebratory. They just make me feel really good to watch the show. And so it felt amazing to be able to finally give that gift back to the city of Detroit and for them to be able to see the pride that was put into the show that's been all over the country, really. That how much Detroit pride is in this show and how much I am going to make sure that all over the world, wherever this musical is done, that you have to know in this story how much Detroit was a part of the foundation of this group that you love.
Dominique, congrats on all the success. Ain't Too Proud, 11 Times of the Temptations, currently in the hometown where it all began. Definitely want to go check it out. And we can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much. Thank you for talking to me and for showing up and continuing to amplify the work that I do.
The one and only Dominique Mariso, Detroit's own. First Black woman to have three shows on Broadway at the same time. One of those Broadway shows, Ain't Too Proud, Life and Times of the Temptations, which is now being staged at the Opera House. Got a chance to see it. Fantastic. You're absolutely going to love it.